Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast brought to you by AIRS LA. That's the Audio Internet Reading Service of Los Angeles. I'm Nancy Porter, and it is my pleasure to bring you selections from Time Magazine. I need to remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers, and no unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. My name is Nancy Porter, and I'll be sharing with you, we've got some back issues to finish up with, from the July 7th, 2025 issue. And this is from the World section. And the title of the article is Arms and the Man. And this is by Adam Razmi in Brussels. Arms and the Man. For NATO chief Mark Rutte, getting Europe to pay more for its defense may be the easy part. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte keeps a variety of mementos in his office. There is a sprawling photograph of the North Sea from the vantage point of his hometown in the Netherlands, a kanji gift from Japan's Minister of Defense, and a framed floral embroidery that reads, "In unity is strength," in Cyrillic, with the stitched flags of NATO, Ukraine, and the EU. But the room's largest ornamental feature is the blue and white map of the world that looms above his conference desk. "In the past, I was responsible for this," the former Dutch prime minister says, pointing to his tiny home country in the northwest corner of Europe. He extends his arms out to encircle the entire Western Defense Alliance that is home to 1 billion people. "And now," he says with a wry laugh, "it's a glimpse of the storms roiling beneath the optimism of the paternal, naturally cheerful Rutte. We are in the steel and glass NATO HQ," that's headquarters, "on the outskirts of Brussels, completed 8 years ago at a cost of $1.3 billion. Its interlocking buildings meant to evoke fingers clasped together in unity. But on this balmy May afternoon, 5 weeks before a critical summit with the mercurial U.S. President Donald Trump and dozens of other leaders, the question of unity hangs over the alliance. It is really a pivotal moment," Rutte says, after we sit down in his office, some 6 short months after he became Secretary General in October. Pivotal may be an understatement. Trump has repeatedly said, most recently in March, that he's not going to defend NATO allies that don't spend enough on their militaries, a threat to the mutual defense commitment at the heart of the alliance. Europeans, awakened to the danger of American inconstancy, are scrambling to spend trillions more on defense in coming years. All the while, Russia's assault on Ukraine grows deadlier by the month. And intelligence from the Baltic states, Denmark, and Germany suggests Moscow could rebuild its armed forces and attack NATO members, Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania within a few years. Rutte, age 58, brings an idiosyncratic mix of experience and personality to the job of saving the alliance. An amateur concert pianist and part-time high school social studies teacher, the center-right politician was the longest-serving Dutch prime minister in history. In that role, he developed a talent for working with people from across the political spectrum in the Netherlands, Europe, and the United States. He even gained a reputation as something of a Trump whisperer. Rutte has used those skills while shuttling between European capitals and Washington, D.C., to push for a new defense spending target of 5% of GDP for NATO members. The goal set by the Trump administration is a stretch. About a quarter of the allies last year failed to reach the current target of 2%. Lurking behind the numbers are hard questions about what European and Canadian allies are capable of on the battlefield. For decades, NATO has depended on the United States for mobile land forces, air defense, long-range weapons systems, and the biggest security shield of all, the nuclear umbrella over the continent. NATO does not work without the nuclear umbrella and all the strategic leadership and strategic force capabilities that the U.S. brings, says General Gordon B. Davis, Jr., retired, a senior fellow at the Center for European Policy Analysis and former top NATO official. The position of Secretary General is mainly a diplomatic one with no direct military authority. But Rutte, a workaholic bachelor with no photos of loved ones in his office, seems to be marshaling member states to meet the moment. His most immediate task is ensuring allies rally around the spending push during the June 24th, 25th NATO summit in his hometown of The Hague. And in that, he's optimistic. "I'm really pretty confident that we'll be a splash," Rutte says. "I see Europeans stepping up." And after that, in its first half century, NATO preserved democracy in post-war Europe, helped defeat the Soviet Union, and served as a synonym for the West. Once Rutte finishes sorting out the books, there awaits the challenge of making sure the alliance remains united and durable for the years to come. Rutte has trained his eyes on the spending target ever since Trump first floated it in January. He is keeping up the push in the weeks before the summit. 2 days after his Time interview, Rutte strolls up to a black Mercedes, arms extended to greet Czech President Peter Pavel as he steps out of the vehicle, brown leather bag in hand. "Welcome back," Rutte smiles, guiding the stoic Pavel, a retired army general and former chairman of the NATO Military Committee, toward the headquarters building. The two men sit down for a closed-door meeting, and afterward, Pavel is direct about his nation's spending commitment. "If the discussion in The Hague leads us to a general agreement that we need to spend up to 5%, Czech Republic is ready to support it," he says at the closing press conference. Others are less forthcoming. A couple of hours after Pavel's positive comments, Rutte greets a beaming Dutch Prime Minister Dick Schoof elsewhere in the building with a hug and launches into talks. At the press conference that caps his visit, Schoof is evasive when asked if the Dutch will agree to the 5% goal. "We will discuss intensively in the cabinet and the parliament, probably as well, on what we are going to do. The Netherlands agreed to the target on June 13th. Getting Europe to pay up may be the most important step in preventing the transactional Trump from undermining the alliance, but managing him requires its own skills. Rutte has repeatedly said that the Trump administration is absolutely right in making more demands of the alliance, and that tone has played well in Washington. "It's great to be with a friend of mine," Trump said at their last meeting in the Oval Office in March. "Every report I've gotten is what a great job he did, and I'm not at all surprised." Rutte's approach also seems to be yielding tangible results. Trump had reportedly threatened to skip the NATO summit, but the White House confirmed on June 3rd that he would attend. The spending push is not just about addressing Trump's complaints that the allies aren't paying their fair share for defense. "This is about practical stuff," Rutte says. "We know that on the Canadian and European side, we lack air defense systems. We lack long-range missiles. We lack logistics systems, maneuverable land formations. Increased European capability would free America up to focus more on China. The U.S. defense budget is continually under pressure. We have real readiness issues after many years of deployment," says Rachel Ellehus, a former advisor to the U.S. NATO mission. "The U.S. is facing its own pressures and really needs its allies to step up. No matter how quickly they do, few think America's NATO allies could stand up to a direct Russian threat without the U.S., which means all of Rutte's efforts on the budget and capabilities fronts would be for naught if Trump simply decided not to come to the defense of alliance members, should the worst come to pass. There is reason to worry it might. Russian sabotage agents against U.S. and European targets tripled from 2023 to 24, according to a Center for Strategic and International Studies report. The head of Germany's intelligence has even warned that sabotage could trigger Article 5, NATO's mutual defense clause. So could a Russian attempt to seize land in former Soviet republics where Russian-speaking minorities are numerous, all of which adds urgency to the cheery Netherlander holding the reins. War and tragedy have loomed over Rutte's life. His father, Isaac, a trader who spent much of his life in Indonesia, then a Dutch colony, survived the Chiding Japanese labor camp. His wife, Petronella, did not, and Isaac married her sister, Mieke. They would live in the country until the 1950s. Rutte was born in The Hague in 1967, the youngest of seven children from his father's two marriages. Some siblings are decades older. One brother died from AIDS in the 1980s, an event he once said drastically changed his worldview. I realize that I will only live once. There is no dress rehearsal. There is only one performance, Rutte said. That is where my enormous drive comes from. Rutte showed an early interest in politics. He joined the youth branch of the center-right People's Party for Freedom and Democracy at age 16. Although his ambition was to be a concert pianist, he chose to pursue a degree in Dutch history at Leiden University instead. Rutte calls the piano his great hobby, but is careful not to play past 9 p.m. because of neighbors living on six sides of him. Then you get calls. Our children are trying to sleep, and by the way, it was not as good as you thought, he laughs. Rutte rose up in the Party for Freedom and Democracy's ranks, becoming national chairman of its youth branch while a student at Leiden. He graduated in 1992 and held a series of human resources jobs at Unilever before taking office as a member of parliament in 2003. Rutte won the People's Party for Freedom and Democracy leadership position in 2006. And in the 2010 elections, led the party to become the largest in parliament for the first time ever. Soon after, he became prime minister, proving himself to be a master coalition builder. Rutte's first government was a coalition with the more right-leaning Christian Democrats, but was propped up by the far-right Property for Freedom, led by the anti-Muslim firebrand Geert Wilders. His second, third, and final cabinets included a mix of social democrats, centrists, and conservatives. He is a very capable politician who is able to bring people together even when they have very different views, said Simon Otjes, a senior assistant professor at Leiden University. Rutte has also been dogged by scandal. His third cabinet resigned in January of 2021, following a parliamentary report that found as many as 10,000 families were forced to repay thousands of euros after they had been wrongly accused of welfare fraud. Another parliamentary report in February of 23 found the Dutch government had for years ignored the risks of drilling gas in Groningen, which had caused the man-made earthquakes that damaged homes and affected thousands of lives. Rutte apologized for both scandals. Throughout various controversies, Rutte had a habit of stating he had no active memory of thornier details. He had a more flexible relationship with the truth, Ortiz says. The end came in July 2023 when he resigned over a migration fight. But even as his political career waned, the next February he secured a critical endorsement from the United States for the top NATO job. The Biden administration considered other candidates, including the more hawkish Kaja Kallas, then Prime Minister of Estonia. But President Biden had liked him, recalls Sean Savette, the former White House National Security Council spokesperson. And Biden and his advisors concluded that Kallas was less likely to be able to win over support from some of the Western European allies. Those who knew Rutte well expected the job would be a big lifestyle shift for him. He had spent years going to the same hairdresser, visiting the same cafes, and eating the same meals at the same restaurants in The Hague. He sometimes drives his closest friends crazy because of all these habits, says Sirk Nawijan, a special advisor to NATO who has worked with Rutte for a decade. Rutte has also kept the same modest apartment in The Hague that he bought with his best friend in his youth. He later shared it with that friend's mother for 20 years until she passed away in 2012 while Rutte was prime minister. Rutte still gets back to The Hague whenever work permits, perhaps in part because of the routines that help keep him grounded. Those include teaching a high school social studies class on Fridays at the Johan de Witt group of schools. I love doing it, Rutte says. It gives you so much energy. The downing of MH17 over Ukraine's Donbas region by Russian-backed forces in July of 2014 may have provided the most formative experience to the future NATO Secretary General. The attack claimed 298 lives, 196 of them Dutch. Rutte says that all illusions he may have had about Vladimir Putin were gone after it took six nights of calls for the Russian president to agree to help families retrieve the remains of loved ones. And then after that, he never, ever, ever was able to accept that the Russians probably made a mistake, a still visibly shaken Rutte says. It has to do with basic decency. The tragedy of Ukraine has stayed with Rutte ever since. He became one of the most frequent wartime visitors to the country and made his first trip as Secretary General there on October 3rd, just 2 days after taking up the NATO post, meeting Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv. In April, he visited Odessa, a city the Ukrainian president has avoided taking world leaders to since last March, when a Russian ballistic missile struck within hundreds of meters of Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. When asked why he was willing to take the risk of traveling there, he said it was just to make the point. It is not only Kyiv, which is under threat. Rutte now helps coordinate outside security assistance to Ukraine, a new responsibility given to NATO by the Biden administration in an attempt to Trump-proof aid. European and Canadian NATO allies have so far this year given more than the estimated $20 billion the U.S. provided in 2024. A German military officer involved in providing support to Ukraine told Reuters that, if necessary, Europe can sustain Ukrainian resistance alone. But the war in Ukraine has also underscored the limits of Rutte's power. Almost a year ago, NATO members agreed to an irreversible path for Ukraine to join the alliance. Rutte finds himself in the middle. On the one hand, he says the deal with Kyiv is still standing. But he adds, to the disappointment of Ukrainian officials, that it doesn't mean that membership is part of a peace deal. That's another delicate issue. Rutte has publicly backed the peace talks that grew out of Trump's view of himself as a dealmaker and have at times raised alarm among others in NATO. The Trump administration's approach has been to put pressure on the victim, Ukraine, rather than on the aggressor, Russia. The U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Bridget Brink, said in April before resigning. Ruta says that the U.S. president is doing exactly what he needs to do. I really commend him for that. Because he broke the deadlock, and is constantly engaging with Ukraine and Russia. Ruta brushed off current concerns that Trump is abandoning his ceasefire efforts at the press conference with Schiff. An agreement must ensure that Putin never again tries to capture one square mile of Ukraine. That is crucial. But the conflict has only escalated, with Russia's launching some of its most extensive strikes in a war that has claimed hundreds of thousands of casualties, and Ukraine's carrying out the audacious Operation Spiderweb drone attack, which damaged or destroyed strategic aircraft inside Russia. The prospect of a ceasefire looks more elusive than ever. NATO, of course, was created to deter an attack by Russia when it was doing business as the Soviet Union. And the U.S. was a key architect of the alliance and the world order Trump is intent on dismantling. So there are easier jobs than the one Ruta holds. And even critics give Ruta high marks for handling Trump and rallying European allies to boost spending and military readiness. The abbreviated NATO summit, reportedly scaled back to keep Trump happy, should be a point of celebration for both men, assuming the funding boost is agreed to as hoped. But the next challenge will be executing those plans. He's got big, big work to do, General Davis says, and there are surprises to come. It helps that he's upbeat. Back at Ruta's office, as our interview begins to wind down, the Secretary General repeats a familiar line about the alliance's ability to outpace Moscow, if it chooses to. The Russian economy is only 5% of the NATO economy. They are $2 trillion. NATO is $50 trillion. And they produce four times as much ammunition as the whole of NATO. Three quarters of a century after its founding, Ruta is confident that NATO can fend off any threat from Moscow. I am pretty much convinced that we are safe for now, he says. But Russia is reconstituting its armed forces, and Ruta warns of the risk of being complacent. If we do not invest much more, plus get the defense industrial production going, he says, the Russians might try something. Optimism, after all, will get you only so far. And we move now to the NATO section of the July 7th issue of Time magazine. And we're now on page 63, and the title of the article is Social Justice. Carolyn Kozoyal says Instagram and TikTok ruined her life. Now she's one of hundreds of plaintiffs fighting back. And this was written by Charlotte Alter. There is no further description of the author. As a freshman in high school, Caroline Kozoyal competed in the Connecticut statewide championship, swimming the 100-yard butterfly in just over a minute. By senior year, she could barely climb the stairs without seeing black spots. In September 2021, Kozoyal's coach had to pull her out of the pool after she nearly passed out during swim practice. My coach was like, "Just eat a granola bar, you'll feel better," says Kozoyal, now a college junior. And I was like, "That's absolutely not going to happen." Back then, Koziol was deep in the grips of an eating disorder that shattered her adolescence. Now she is suing the social media giants Meta and TikTok, alleging that the design of their products contributed to her anorexia and made it more difficult for her to recover. When Koziol was stuck at home during the COVID-19 pandemic, she started looking up at-home workouts on social media to keep herself in shape for swimming and searched for healthy recipes to make with her mom. Within weeks, her Instagram and TikTok feeds were full of content promoting extreme workouts and disordered eating. One innocent search turned into this avalanche, she says, sipping iced coffee at a shop near her parents' home in Hartford. It just began to overtake every thought that I had. Koziol, now age 21, is among more than 1,800 plaintiffs suing the companies behind several leading social media platforms as part of a case that could reshape their role in American society. The plaintiffs include young adults recovering from mental health problems, the parents of suicide victims, school districts dealing with phone addiction, local governments, and 29 states' attorneys general. They've joined together as part of a multi-district litigation, a type of lawsuit which consolidates similar complaints around the country into one case to streamline pre-trial proceedings, which is now moving through federal court in the Northern District of California. The plaintiffs allege that the products created by social media giants are addictive and dangerous, that the defendants have relentlessly pursued a strategy of growth at all costs, recklessly ignoring the impact of their products on children's mental and physical health, and that young people like Caroline Koziol are the direct victims of intentional product design choices made by each defendant. The MDL is expected to reach trial next spring. It comes as a social media is monopolizing more and more attention from children and teens. The average teenager in the United States spends nearly 5 hours per day on social media, according to a 2023 Gallup poll. Those who spend more than 3 hours a day on it daily have double the risk of depression and anxiety. One study found that clinical depression among young people was up 60% from 2017 to 2021, which critics attribute partly to rising social media use. Overall, 41% of teens with high social media use rate their mental health as poor or very poor, according to the American Psychological Association. Social media is associated with significant mental health harms for adolescents, wrote former Surgeon General Vivek Murphy, who argues for putting warning labels on social media platforms as the same as the U.S. does with tobacco. As some of the most powerful companies in the world to monetize their attention, kids across the country are struggling with the consequences of social media addiction. They're being stalked by these companies, stalked by these really disturbed values and beauty ideas, stalked by the phone in their hand, says Dr. S. Brian Austin, a professor of behavioral science at the Harvard School of Public Health. The algorithm is finding them no matter what they're doing. To critics, there's little question why. Austin co-published research which estimated that in 2022 alone, children under the age of 17 delivered nearly $11 billion in advertising revenue to Facebook, Instagram, Snap, TikTok, with Twitter, and YouTube. Legislative efforts to regulate social media companies have mostly stalled in Congress. And the plaintiff's attorneys in the social media MDL say this case represents the best hope of holding those tech companies accountable in court. and getting justice for those who have been harmed. The MDL, says co-lead plaintiff's lawyer, Previn Warren of Motley Rice, is a giant coordinated siege by families and AGs unlike anything we have seen since the opioid crisis. The plaintiffs argue the companies were aware of the ramifications for young users, yet still designed their products to maximize addictiveness anyway. Internal documents obtained by the Wall Street Journal in 2021 suggest that Facebook, now called Meta, knew that Instagram was harming girls' mental health. We make body image issues worse for 1 in 3 teen girls, said one slide presenting internal research. Meta disputes this characterization, saying the same internal research shows teen girls were more likely to say Instagram made them feel better than worse. These companies knew that there was a disproportionate effect on young women, says Koziol's lawyer, Jessica Carroll of Motley Rice. She represents eating disorder clients as young as 13 years old, including some who have been on social media since they were age 10. I think that they experimented on a generation of young people, and we are seeing the effects of that today. Suing social media companies is a difficult challenge. Most digital speech is protected by the First Amendment, and social media platforms have long asserted protections under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which grants them immunity from liability for content they host. But the plaintiffs in the MDL aren't suing over content. They're suing on product liability and negligence grounds, alleging that defective design features hook children to the platforms and allow them to evade parental consent, while the recommendation algorithms manipulate kids to keep them on the apps. Koziol isn't suing Instagram's and TikTok's parent companies for hosting content that drove her to an eating disorder. She's alleging that the platforms are designed to maximize her engagement. And as a result, she was drawn deeper and deeper into anorexia content. If I saw one or two videos, it wouldn't have made a difference, Koziol says. But when it was all that I was seeing, that's when it became obsessive. Critics say that bombardment is a deliberate feature, not a bug. They have a machine learning recommendation system that is oriented toward growth at all costs, says Carroll, which means anything to keep eyeballs on it. Meta, which owns Instagram, says it has sought to combat the harms experienced by underage users by rolling out new restrictions. As of last year, any Instagram user from the ages of 13 to 18 will default to what Meta calls a teen account, which is automatically private, limits sensitive content, turns off notifications at night, and does not allow messaging with anyone without mutual contacts. The teen accounts are meant to address key concerns that parents have about teens on the app, which Meta spokeswoman Liza Crenshaw described as content, contact, and time. Meta has also developed classifiers, she said, AI programs that scan for problematic content to remove. We know parents are worried about having unsafe or inappropriate experiences online, and that's why we have significantly changed the Instagram experience for tens of millions of teens with new teen accounts, Crenshaw said in a statement to Time magazine. These accounts provide teens with built-in protections to automatically limit who is contacting them and the content they are seeing. And teens under age 16 need a parent's permission to change those settings. We also give parents oversight over the teens' use of Instagram, with ways to see who their teens are chatting with and block them from using the app for more than 15 minutes a day or for certain periods of time, like during school or at night. Despite repeated requests, TikTok did not provide a comment for this story. Caroline Koziol's parents thought she was too young for social media as a preteen, but many of her friends in elementary schools already had accounts on Instagram and TikTok, and Koziol felt left out. Both platforms have an age limit of 13. Koziol says she signed up when she was 10 or 11. I was able to lie about my age really easily and make an account, she recalls. My parents had no idea. Age verification is an interesting wide challenge, says Crenshaw, adding that this year Meta started testing a new AI tool designed to proactively find accounts of teens masquerading as adults and transition them to teen accounts. Meta supports federal legislation that requires app stores to get parental approval whenever a teen under 16 downloads an app. As the competitive swimmer, Koziol had spent much of her life in a bathing suit and was comfortable in her body. I never thought twice about other people's bodies or my own, she says. What she cared about was her athletic career. Her dream was to swim competitively in college. Then she began spending time on Instagram and TikTok. I started using social media and I'm like, oh, I have really broad shoulders compared to a lot of girls, she recalls. Or, oh, my thighs touch. Whereas the fitness influencers, their thighs don't touch. When the pandemic hit, her school went remote and swim practice was canceled. Koziol knew that even a few days away from the pool could weaken her endurance and make her less competitive. Worried about losing muscle mass, she searched on Instagram for 30-minute at-home workout or cardio workout at home. She was also filling free time by baking with her mom and started looking up healthy recipes to make. My searches were never low calorie, low fat, Koziol says. It was healthy. Dramatic evolution of the content the algorithm served to her was apparent only in retrospect. It was so nefarious, she says. Searching for healthy recipes led her to low-calorie recipes. Searching for at-home workouts led her to videos of skinny influencers in workout clothes, body checking for the camera. Something in my algorithm just switched, she says. There was nothing I could do. A healthy teenager who wanted to see memes and funny videos and exchange messages with her friends suddenly had her feed filled with very thin girls in workout clothing showing off their bodies. Before too long, her daily diet shrank to just a protein bar or two. Sometimes she ate nothing at all until dinner. For months, she subsisted mostly on baby puffs and Diet Coke, just to fill my stomach, even as she forced herself to do hours of cardio. Meanwhile, the algorithm supplied images of skinnier and skinnier girls, or more and more extreme diets. Other users chimed in with comments on those posts, Koziol said, suggesting tips and tricks to feel like you're eating something. She kept her car stocked with paper towels, wipes, and extra mascara so that she could reapply makeup after forcing herself to vomit on the side of the road. By her junior year, I was addicted to this empty feeling, Koziol says. Being on social media was like getting sucked into a dark hole. She lost 30 pounds in a year. Her eating disorders led to issues with her throat and teeth and hormonal problems that caused hot flashes and night sweats. Her brain felt fuzzy as her short-term memory faltered from malnutrition. "I was like a zombie," she says. "I was not the same person." Her parents realized something was wrong, and Koziol started outpatient treatment for anorexia the summer after her junior year. She met with psychiatrists, dietitians, and therapists. Nothing could break the algorithm's grip. When my thoughts correlated with what I was seeing on my phone, it just felt normal, she says. I really didn't even see a problem with it. Senior year, she missed half her classes to attend treatment. She wasn't able to take the advanced placement course load she had hoped, and only graduated because of all the extra credits she had taken earlier in high school. Instead of going to college, she went to Monte Nido, an inpatient anorexia treatment facility in Irvington, New York. Dr. Molly Perlman, the facility's chief medical officer, says that while many eating disorders have an underlying genetic component, they are triggered by social environments, and photo-based social media platforms are a perfect trigger. Perlman says that not only have those apps contributed to the rise of eating disorders, they have also made them far more difficult to treat. The algorithms are very smart, and they know their users, and they know what those users will click on, Perlman says. These are malnourished, vulnerable brains that are working toward finding recovery, and yet the algorithms are capitalizing on their disease. Toward the end of Koziol's six-week stay at Monte Nido in the summer of 2022, her therapy group had a phone cleansing day. All the patients were asked to either delete social media altogether or to block harmful hashtags. The facility was filled with women of different ages, races, backgrounds, and hometowns. But when everyone opened their phones, Koziol noticed that their Instagram feeds looked exactly like hers. "We had the same creators," she said, "the same posts, the exact same content." For all their differences, these women were being fed the exact same pro-anorexia content. "It showed me that this algorithm doesn't care about who you are," Koziol said. "All they need is that first little search." Gabby Cusato's story started out a lot like Koziol's. Gabby was a competitive athlete too, a cross-country runner. She was part of a tight-knit family from upstate New York, a quadruplet with two older siblings and loving parents. Gabby's parents got her a phone in seventh grade to help the family coordinate pickups from multiple different sports practices. She had one Instagram account her parents knew about, and several others that were secret. Imagine being 15. You want to be fast. You want to be skinny, says Gabby's mother, Karen. And if somebody is saying to you, "Here's how you can do it. Here's how you can lose more weight," it's just a rabbit hole. After her drastic weight change, Karen Cusato enrolled Gabby in intensive outpatient treatment for anorexia. She went 3 days a week for 4 hours a day. But as soon as she got out of therapy, she would be back on her phone. One of her Instagram accounts was devoted to her eating disorder treatment. Gabby posted pictures of healthy meals she ate during her recovery. Jessica Carroll, who also represents the Cusato family, says the accounts may have aggravated Gabby's problem. "By creating this account," Carol says, "she's almost inviting the algorithm to send her more of this stuff." One day in November of 2019, Karen Cusato confiscated Gabby's phone after an argument and sent her to her room. thinking that her daughter could cool off and they could patch things up in the morning. The next morning, Gabby's bed was made, but she was nowhere to be found. At first, Kusato and her husband thought she'd run away. Then we found her in the closet, Kusato recalls. The scream from my husband is something that I can never unhear. Gabby had died by suicide. She was 15 years old. Most days, Kusato blames herself, but she knows this would not have happened if Gabby had not become so addicted to social media. If she was born 20 years earlier, this would not have taken place, she says. If Kusato could do it again, she'd buy her daughter a phone without internet access. Never in my wildest dreams did I think that this was what the phone could turn into. I think she felt less than perfect, Kusato says. The algorithms were giving an ideal weight for an ideal height, and she was chasing that number, and you know, she didn't get to that number that she thought was going to make her happy. Anorexia has the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric disorder, not just because of the malnutrition involved, but because it is often clustered with depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation. Carol says that nearly half of the personal injury cases represented by her firm in the MDL are related to eating disorders. Kusato has been a high school math teacher for more than two decades. Every year, she stands in front of classes of kids who are the same age Gabby was when she died. During the years she has spent in the classroom, she has noticed a change take place in her students. Were kids depressed before? Yes, she says. Were they depressed in the numbers they are now? Absolutely not. The suits filed by Koziol, the Kusatos, and others represent a new phase in the effort to combat social media harms. The strategy of these companies is to do anything they can to distort the language of Section 230 to protect them with impunity, says Mary Graw, a law professor at the Catholic University of America, who has written extensively about Section 230. As a result, we have an unregulated industry which is used by most of the globe with the potential to cause massive harm, and no way to look under the hood to see what the industry is doing. It is stunning. No other industry has such avoidance of accountability. But social media MDL cleared a major obstacle in November 2023 when a federal judge in California ruled that many of the lawsuits could proceed. While Judge Yvonne Gonzalez-Rogers narrowed the scope of the litigation, she ruled that many of the negligence and product liability claims are not barred by either the First Amendment or Section 230. Multi-district litigation is often slow and unwieldy, since it contains many district cases with different plaintiffs seeking different damages. The school districts, for example, want something different than the attorneys general do. Personal injury plaintiffs like the Koziol and the Kusatos are seeking compensation for medical bills, pain and suffering, and punitive damages for what they say was reckless, malicious conduct by the social media companies. They also want injunctive relief, a formal ruling from the judge stating that the platforms are defectively designed and court orders requiring companies to remove addictive or dangerous features, add warnings, and strengthen safeguards. The fact discovery phase of the case, in which both parties exchanged documents and testimony, closed in April. The two sides are preparing for a motion of summary judgment in the fall, when the judge will decide if the case will go to trial. Koziol can't point to any one piece of content that caused her eating disorder. To her, it's the constant bombardment of all of those videos that led her to the brink of starvation. No third party is responsible for the algorithm, she says. That's Meta and TikTok alone. While she's seeking financial compensation for her eating disorder treatment, as well as other financial damages, Koziol says the purpose of the suit is to hold those corporations accountable. They knew what they did was wrong, she says. What they were doing was harming young girls, and it ruined my life. Koziol has been accepted to her dream school, the University of South Carolina. She has imagined joining a sorority and going to SEC football games on Saturdays. She even had a roommate lined up before she decided to take a year off to focus on her recovery. By the time she was ready for college, her therapist warned her that going so far away could trigger a relapse. Instead, she enrolled at University of Hartford, closer to home. Greek life and football aren't in the cards right now. She's not on the same track as most of her old friends. She had to quit swimming. Even after everything she's been through, Koziol can't bring herself to delete her social media entirely. Instagram is so ubiquitous that it feels impossible to be a young person without it. She has blocked certain hashtags from her Instagram, reset her account, and unfollowed harmful creators. Still, the algorithm finds ways to tempt her. It's taken a lot of work to not interact with the disordered content that occasionally comes up, she says. I always have to remind myself, the second I click on it, I'm going to get another post tomorrow, and then another post tomorrow, and then another post tomorrow. And this ends with this information. If you or someone you know needs help, call the National Alliance for Eating Disorders hotline at area code 866-662-1235 or the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 988. And that includes my time coverage of the July 7th, 2025 issue. Again, I need to remind you that you have been listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Materials on AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers, and no unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Again, I'm Nancy Porter, and it has been my pleasure to share Time Magazine with you.